Why do we believe what we believe? That's a question Dr. Danegal Young went viral for answering in her 2020 TED Talk, The Psychological Traits That Shape Your Political Beliefs. As a professor of communication and political science at the University of Delaware, she studies how people understand the world and what that means for society and democracy, as she's shared in appearances on CNN, NBC, and other outlets. Her book, Irony and Outrage, explains why liberals gravitate toward satire like Last Week Tonight and why conservatives toward opinion programs like Sean Hannity. Dr. Young joined 10 Minute Talks to share how our differences are used to divide us, but how we can use them to find unity. This is our conversation.
From the time that I started graduate school, I had been studying political humor, political jokes, back to the time of Jay Leno and Dave Letterman. And over time, people would always say, oh, it's so weird. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of conservative political satire. And I was like, yeah, it really doesn't. I mean, there would be some instances, some examples, but overall, right, the genre is dominated by liberals. So what is that about? And I came up with some answers, but they just weren't cutting it for me. And at the same time, it became clear that programming like Rush Limbaugh or Fox News is a lot more lucrative and has much wider appeal than the similar kinds of programs that exist for liberals. Like, you know, Rachel Maddow historically has not been able to compete with Sean Hannity. There are some times when her ratings get up there, but in general, like, Rush Limbaugh owns that space. Even when liberals have tried to create that kind of programming, it really hasn't worked. So the thought was, maybe there is something inherent in not the content necessarily of what they're saying, but the package that they're putting it in that appeals to each of those psychological profiles. And, you know, when you look at the literature on political psychology, indeed, social and cultural conservatives and social and cultural liberals don't just see policy as things that need to be different, or issues. They also have different psychological traits, that things that have to do with how tolerant they are of uncertainty in their worlds, how much they need closure, how okay they are with sort of novelty, or do they prefer predictability? And so I did some analyses where I wove these political psychological traits into an understanding of who is watching what. And it turns out that these traits are likely at least somewhat responsible for these attractions to these distinct kinds of genres with liberals and their high tolerance for uncertainty and their low threat salience. Liberals are less likely to be monitoring for threat. That sort of allows them to be open to more hybrid forms of political programming and programming that is ironic and ambiguous and open-ended, right? As opposed to conservatives who need closure and certainty, who are more attracted to content that is threat-oriented and didactic and instructive and serious.
In your TED Talk, you say that the link between psychology and politics is contingent on context, and that the problem is the dominant context is our political and media environment, which often uses our differences to divide us. Can you break that down?
Yeah, no, that's great. I love this. So here's the thing. There's a theory called social identity theory that says that each of us has these different social roles that we play in the world, right? So I am a mom, I am a dog owner, I'm a professor, I'm a gardener. Now, which of these social roles that I'm thinking of myself as is going to depend on what's going on around me? So right now, I'm not thinking of myself as a gardener, I'm thinking of myself as a professor because we're talking about my research, right? So when there is a context that constantly reminds us of one of our identities, that identity is going to become dominant and then is going to shape everything that we think and do and how we engage with the world. And right now, because a political party is really sort of encapsulates all kinds of things right now, right? Political party is increasingly correlated with things like not only psychology, but also race, religion, geography. There are these huge divides. Lily Mason's work talks about how we are socially sorted. So liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, they experience the world very differently. And internally, the parties are more homogeneous, right? Because of that, what's going to end up happening is that any time that your political identity is activated, it's going to activate all these other sort of primal associations. And that is going to get us more and more entrenched in our worldview. And it's going to get our egos so tightly wedded to our political identities in ways that are problematic, right? It's really not good for us always to be thinking of ourselves in terms of our political identities, because that, especially in this divided climate, is going to always reinforce those divisions, as opposed to interacting with people based on shared experiences, right? Connecting with people, which is so hard in the context of a pandemic when people are socially isolated, but increasingly finding ways to communicate on grounds that are quite independent of political identity.
You reference in the book that trust in news media is at an all-time low. We also are very distrusting of people who have opposing political beliefs. With all of that, do you have any advice on how we can have productive conversations with someone of a different belief?
Yeah, one thing that I think is helpful is recognizing that if someone has a different political value system from you, and I'll be honest, like doing the research for this book helped me a lot, recognizing that the different kinds of psychological traits and value systems that accompany conservatism and liberalism, both are necessary for the world to function. And if you can start thinking about, if you are a liberal and you're like, oh, conservatives are all this way and they all want to go backwards and they all this or that, if you start recognizing that the values and psychological traits of conservatism are valuable for stability and security and for threat monitoring, you can start thinking like, okay, these are invaluable members of society, especially if you're like an artist or a musician, et cetera. In order for you to do your craft, is it possible that maybe you need someone minding the store to make sure that society is stable and safe and secure? And are you doing that? You might not be. So, you know, recognizing those things. And on the other side, if you are conservative and you think, oh, these comedians and these entertainers, they, you know, what do they give? Or what are they doing to keep us safe? Well, they might not be actually like minding the borders, but liberals will have those traits and values that would lead to things like innovation and the development of new technologies and new art forms and culture that might make a society worth protecting and stabilizing in the first place. So if we start thinking about things that way, that can ignite a bit of empathy to be able to approach people from the other side with this notion of this emotional welcome mat, which is that I see you, I recognize you, I respect you, I see that you approach the world differently from me, and we can find things to connect on, especially at an interpersonal level, about the shared experience of what it is to be human, things like pain and suffering and the daily trite experiences of, you know, parenting or being a student or a brother or sister. These are the places where connections are made.
I think that's so important about finding that common ground with people, especially because everyone always says all good relationships start with compromise, but that's a whole other ballgame when it comes to politics.
Whole other ballgame. And, you know, some of those rifts are really insurmountable. And so if you think of relationships with folks as being all or nothing and say, if they do not believe this, I cannot have them in my life, that's a very tricky place to start. Now, that being said, when it comes to issues of race and misogyny and LGBTQ issues, those, if you are someone who is trying to cultivate a relationship with an individual who holds a racist ideology or believes a certain way about the role of women or transgender people, it is up to the individual to say, is this a battle worth fighting for me? Are there aspects of common ground that we can come to say, yes, everyone deserves to live with dignity. And what does that mean? You got to really do the cost-benefit analysis of how much it's worth to you to try to work on those very, very more challenging issues.
Do you think that understanding the physiological, psychological, environmental causes behind someone else's political beliefs can help foster more empathy between each side?
I do. And, you know, sometimes I get a little bit nervous when we talk about political psychology and we start learning that some of these things actually may be related to genetics, that therefore are traits determined from birth? And does that mean that people can't change? First of all, that's not what it means. But even if there are genetic predispositions, people are malleable and life matters and experience matters. And those sort of genetic predispositions may be activated or enacted in different ways based on people's lives. But what I like about it is that it recognizes that, you know, in the same way, for example, in the same way that the recognition that being gay is something that comes from birth, I think that that recognition, if you accept that truth, folks are far more accepting of gays and lesbians because there's the recognition that this is a biological truth. This is a biological reality, right? I think if we really do start thinking about some of these psychological traits as outcomes of biology, that can be helpful, right? Because it says like, okay, these things are here, they exist, they're enacted in this way, maybe they have a functional role to play, and what might those be? And where I do become more, I would say more suspicious and more cynical is in the motives of entities that exploit those profiles for profit, for power. So there are, you know, politicians and folks in media and platforms and network executives that exploit those traits in certain ways. For them, I don't have empathy, right? Because I find that quite cynical. But for the individuals who have these traits, I do think that it's useful to recognize the sort of biological function that some of these traits may play.
Yeah, Brené Brown talks a lot about how shame is not a social justice tool. What do you think about that in the context of how it applies to having political discussions?
There is a theory called face negotiation theory. And the idea is that everyone wants to save face, which is about sort of pride and dignity and being able to feel reputationally like you still look good. And different cultures deal with it differently. And one of the things that I find interesting is the role that each of us plays in trying to allow another person to save face. And the social media environment does not encourage that. It really sort of encourages this sort of like pointing fingers and saying, you know, you did this awful thing and you're terrible. But interpersonally, it is really, really important for society that we allow people to save face. And you give them an opportunity to still be respected and still walk with dignity. And what that means is connecting and saying, especially in the context of something like disinformation or conspiracy theories, saying, look, the world is upside down. We're in a pandemic. Everything is bonkers. Of course, we're going to want to make sense of the world. Of course, we're going to try to put pieces together to try to explain what's going on. It totally is understandable, right? Basically allowing that person to save face and say like, yeah, I think maybe that's why I did look up some of these crazy websites. And I found myself drawn to them because things are so bonkers out there. Those little gestures can go a long way in allowing the person to let their defenses down and to reconnect with you.
Yeah. Something I see a lot is this level of extremism where it's not just, I can't be friends with you if you believe differently than me politically, but I can't be friends with you if you're friends with someone who believes different from me politically. And I struggle with that a lot because my friend group is very diverse and I value having a lot of people around me with different beliefs. Can you speak to that person who's of the belief that we can't be friends with or even be friends with others who have opposing political beliefs? And what some of the benefits might be of having those relationships?
Yeah, that is so tricky, especially because it really does depend on whether or not we're talking about folks who have, I think we can't talk about these issues without acknowledging that there's, you know, racism and misogyny run deep in these crevices and they create these divides. And I would never say to a person of color, no, it's good for you to have these folks in your life because, you know, it might help you bridge the divide. That is not their work to do. But in terms of, if we're talking about other kinds of political divides, it really, the more we become as a culture separated into these enclaves, the less functional democracy becomes. And so I come back to this as a political scientist, because I'm like, look, without our system of government, we're done. It's gonna be Lord of the Flies up in here. So we need democracy to be able to function. And for democracy to be able to function, we have to be able to have respectful conversations with people who disagree with us. We also need for individuals, that being said, we also need for individuals to see us as equal human beings. And to the extent that that's not happening, then the onus is on that other person to change. And one of the things that is very tricky is in social media spaces, which are really protected through anonymity, there is the intentional silencing of certain kinds of voices. And, you know, folks on the right talk about cancel culture, but folks on the left are dealing with threats against especially Black women and transgender women online. And so we got to figure out, like, are we going to honor the reality that everyone has a seat at the table? Are we going to honor the reality that democracy means we all get to speak? And if we're not, then it needs to be acknowledged that we are going to move in a different direction that is not a democratic direction. So that's my big pitch. And I think it's important for, and I think that the silencing happens in different ways on the right and the left. And as someone who has endured a lot of harmful and hateful speech online, I recognize that, yeah, there are folks who really just don't want me talking because I'm a woman and I have a PhD. And so that's like, that's not how the rules work. That's not how things work. So yeah, everyone needs to have a seat at the table.
That was my conversation with Dr. Young. To find her book and more resources, check out the show description and make sure to subscribe if you want to be the first to hear part 2 of our conversation. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or a comment on YouTube and let me know what your takeaways were. Until next time, remember you're loved, you matter, and you've got this.